Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility presents the Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, exploring ideas with innovators, change makers, business leaders, politicians, and activists. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by the Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, a proud B Corp using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. Stowe Cider, with crisp, clean, and creative award-winning flavors. Visit the tasting room in Stowe or buy Stowe Cider throughout New England, upstate New York, and Washington, D.C. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as Salvation Farms, which nourishes Vermont by distributing produce that farmers can't sell, as well as nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Learn more at www.vbsr.org. Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Our guest for the hour this week is former Governor Madeline Cunin. Madeline Cunin became the first woman to be elected governor of Vermont in 1984. She served three terms. She was also American ambassador to Switzerland and a U.S. Deputy Secretary of Education. Today, Madeline Cunin is the James Marsh Professor at Large at the University of Vermont, where she gives guest lectures on feminism, women, and politics. And she is the author of a new book. This is her fourth. It is titled Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Madeline Cunin, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Well, it's great to be back here, David.
This book is different than all your others, and I thought there'd be no better way to start than to have you read a little bit from it. This book is a collection of both poetry and prose, and you open the book with a poem called No Longer. I wonder if you could read that for us.
I'd be glad to. Thank you. No longer will we make love before breakfast. No longer will I dream of seeing New Zealand or the Cape of Good Hope or bears in the wild. No longer will I say yes more than no. No longer will danger sparkle and safety look dull. No longer will I look at my body without comparison between who I was and who I have become, blaming the light for the difference. No longer can I toss my hair over my face and count 100 strokes. No longer can I do without night cream and day cream, slathering on ounce after ounce. No longer can I be comfortable sitting in my chair reading for hours without getting up to stretch my arms and legs. No longer can I walk without looking down at my feet to avoid mean cracks and malicious bumps. No longer can I skip down the stairs like a girl flying without feeling a thing. No longer can I approach the precipice without swaying against my will. No longer do I think ahead of where I will be in 10 years or 20 or more. Now I think in ones or twos or threes, long enough to still hunger for the food of life. No longer do I wish for the next day or the next year to come quickly, like I did the year I turned 10. I want the days to saunter, like a leisurely museum stroller who stops now and then to gaze and get closer to the cameras to see the brushstrokes, and then steps back for the long view before moving on.
Thank you. What made you decide to write this book?
Well, getting older and stepping out of public life, not being in elective office, and I found as the years accumulated that life was different, different feelings, both physical and mental, and that not being in the public eye as governor or as an ambassador was a kind of liberty, that I could think more deeply, have more time, and really try to define what was happening to me. You know, as a public person, as you know, you're sort of shrink-wrapped. You're careful because what you might say might work against you. And obviously, I still have some kind of screen which I filter my thoughts through, but I'm much freer. And to write poetry, to write anything, you really have to be able to dig a little and have some time to try to interpret. I mean, the things that happened to you, like not being able to hike Mount Mansfield anymore, but other things, it was just a very interesting experience. And then I thought to myself, well, other people may be feeling the same thing. So this is sort of a private book. And at some point, I got a little anxious about that. Sort of a writer's remorse. Have I spilled out too much of myself for public scrutiny? And then I sort of got used to it. And now sometimes I think somebody else wrote this book, and I'm just here talking about it.
It is, I think, one of the things I have enjoyed so much about this book is that it is very intimate, and unusually so for a writer, but especially so for a public figure. What did it take for you to feel okay? I mean, you speak in here about, you know, the feelings about, you know, intimacy with your husband, about all kinds of things that public people don't normally talk about. What did it take for you to feel okay that it was going to be okay to be public with this?
Well, I guess I trusted the public in a way. But I never knew how they would react. I have to say I'm surprised by the reaction now. And when I give a book talk, there's laughter. And I write about, you know, buying two big red chairs and debating what to do with them after we bought them. And, you know, for a writer, the best response is laughter. It shows they kind of get it and they're with you. So the response by all age groups, I thought only people over 65 are going to like this book, but that hasn't happened. Young people respond to it. So it's been a very fulfilling adventure so far.
I think that's interesting, that idea that you trust your audience and trust the public. I mean, you have been in a very public relationship with Vermonters for nearly a half century. And you're expressing a kind of intimacy with Vermonters here. It strikes me that you feel that the relationship can handle you being honest about life in old age.
I guess so. We'll see as time goes on. The book just came out October 2nd. So I've just been in Vermont, but I'm going to be giving talks out of state too. But it's been a very positive experience, and I'm delighted with that.
How long did it take you to kind of shed that cloak of caution and, you know, measuring your words that you had when you were, you know, a public figure in the various offices you've held?
Well, it didn't happen overnight. I think it's just I discovered a new part of me. And I think writing poetry, which is sometimes more introspective than writing prose, and writing poetry really transformed me in a way.
How long have you been writing poetry?
Well, you know, I probably wrote my first poem in seventh grade, but I haven't been writing it steadily. And for the last 4 years, I've been more of a poet than not.
We're spending the hour this week on the Vermont Conversation with former Governor Madeleine Cunin. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 244-1777 or toll-free 877-291-8255. Well, I'd love to talk about some of the things that you talk about in the book. One was your political awakening, and you describe that it came when you joined your first husband, Arthur, on a sabbatical that he had in Switzerland. You saw something different in Switzerland. What was it that you saw, and what was the awakening that occurred for you?
Well, the Swiss women, shockingly, didn't achieve the right to vote till 1971, and we had our sabbatical there in Bern with our four children, and they had debates about the right to vote on television, on the radio, and I thought to myself, here the women are fighting like suffragists, and in the United States we've had the right to vote so long, but we don't have women involved in politics. So, and at that point, all the new feminist books came out here in the United States, and so I thought, when I get home, I'm going to do something about it. And the Women's Campaign Fund was forming, and it just grabbed me. And so slowly but surely, I decided to run for office. I guess it wasn't so slowly, but it wasn't like the minute I landed back in the United States. It was when the feminist movement was really bubbling.
And it was 1974, I think, that you first ran for office.
72.
And it was for which office?
Legislature, yes. And I was fortunate. There was an open seat. And, you know, when I started out, I wasn't sure I would like politics. I'd always been interested in current events, but I didn't know about throwing myself into the fray. And slowly I began to say, yeah, this is interesting. This is even fun at times. And I found that I enjoyed it, and I got over my shyness. I guess people would be surprised to know that I'm or was a very shy person. And in some ways, I still am shy, which brings me back to the book. You know, we view politicians in sort of one-dimensional ways, almost as caricatures. You're either liberal or conservative. You're either this or that. And in a way, I was thinking about it last night. I think I wrote the book to show that there's more to me than that, that there is nuance in life, and it's not always black and white or right or wrong. And I guess I sort of wanted to talk about who I am and my background. I mean, people don't know, for example, that my father died when I was 2.5 years old. And I explore that in this book. What does that mean? What did that mean to me?
And but you committed suicide.
Yes, but it's not something, even now as you say that, it's sort of hard for me to hear. But I sort of tried to show a three-dimensional portrait of where I come from and, excuse me, and who I am.
Why is that important to you, particularly now?
Well, I think as you get older, you think more about the past. And you know, I think Ancestry.com is so popular because people want to know their own history and their own genealogy. So I just think it fulfills a curiosity you have about yourself. Am I left-handed because my grandparents were left-handed, or do I play the piano because somebody else has played the piano in my family? So it's curiosity, and I think it's healthy.
Mm-hmm. You write at some length and with great compassion about your father's suicide and his struggles with depression. And you also write about your brother, your brother's death. Edgar,
yes.
Who died in what year?
4 years ago.
You write, mourning does not have an end point. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think you ease out of it slowly, but it's always with you to some degree. If you're very, very close to someone, you know, I experienced it more recently with the death of my husband, and it just stays with you in a more subdued way, because you know, ordinary life steps in again, and you go back to your routines. But in the back of your mind, you never stop missing somebody, like a husband, a child, a brother or sister.
Your husband John passed away at the beginning of this year, and you dedicate the book to him. I imagine he read parts of this book. He was a reader of all of your previous books.
Yes, he read all of this book in the first draft. There's some small changes, but yeah, he read everything I wrote. He encouraged me to write, and I wrote two other books while we were married, and he was a good editor, and I valued his advice. And this book is really a love story about him, too. So I didn't want to publish something that would have made him embarrassed or angry. He sort of blanched a little bit at a couple of places, but he never said, "Don't do this."
What did he feel about you kind of... I mean, you share in here a lot about your life with him.
Well, what I share is that his slow decline, he was always a very optimistic, let's do it kind of person. And it was hard to see old age kind of take over. And he found it very hard. My hope would be that there'd be another couple somewhere who could understand that and could resonate. You know, as we all get older, and the older population is dominating some parts of our lives, people are looking for answers or looking for examples or not to feel alone. And so I felt it was very important for him to read it.
The issue of loneliness when you were a single woman is something you write about with great eloquence in here. And you describe a scene where when you were living in D.C., when you were the Deputy Secretary of Education, and you describe what you call the challenge of powerful women. It's like you felt like you had blinking caution lights when, you know, whether you would go dating or whatever. Talk about what the loneliness that you felt in that at that time.
Well, it's not so easy even now as I'm talking to you to talk about it, but sometimes powerful, strong women give off this flashing yellow light, and a lot of men are intimidated by that. Is this going to be a tough woman? Is she going to boss me around? But the great part about John was he never felt that way. And we really had a total egalitarian relationship. But I think that's true for women CEOs, for women politicians. But I think that's becoming less so as people begin to admire what women do in this day and age. And I think as women achieve the first astronaut or the first secretary of this or that, they'll get used to the idea and realize that it isn't that the woman is dominant if she's successful. It's just that she's successful, and a successful man and a successful woman are great partners.
When you were ambassador to Switzerland, you describe, you know, one of the issues. So after you and your first husband, Arthur, were divorced. So you were holding these very public roles as a single woman, ambassador to Switzerland. And you describe asking there's an annual ball, the Marine Ball, and you didn't feel that you could show up at that alone without a partner. So you asked the ambassador to France to join you and do the first dance. Tell me a little bit about that and for why the ambassador to France?
Well, I don't know. It just, I had gotten to know him, and so it was just an easy choice. He was the ambassador from France to Switzerland, and we had a good time.
And you also describe it was sometimes a little bit excruciating, you know, when you would have these public events and you would have to sort of just what it was like for you, and people would, I guess, the burden of appearing single but wanting to, how did you address that? You talk about that in the book. So how do you feel like you addressed that?
Well, I learned to do things alone. And then I had friends. It was actually a gay couple that I went to public events with. And I got better at it with time, because I wasn't alone in that position as a single woman. But I got used to it, and I got better at it, that I could feel perfectly comfortable and sociable.
You and your brother Edgar had a very special relationship, but one that is potentially challenging. When you were governor, he was chair of Senate Appropriations. So who had more power in that situation?
Well, as governor, I did, but he had a lot of power too. And there was a little friction where he had certain priorities on the Appropriations Committee, and I had certain priorities with the budget of the state of Vermont. But 99% of the time we agreed. We really had the same values, similar ideas, and it was, but sometimes it was talked about that, you know, whenever we differed, it became an issue. But we were also in the House at the same time before I was governor. And when there was a roll call, and my brother's name was Edgar May, and May comes after Cunin. So when he voted after me and voted the same way, somebody would quip, hey, you're voting with your sister again. And that did not make my brother particularly pleased. So one day he asked the clerk to call the roll backwards so that May would come first. And it discombobulated everybody in the House, because they didn't know when they should vote. They were so used to their place in the alphabet. So that only happened once.
One of the stories you tell in your new book, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, was about your time in Switzerland. And, you know, this is a time where Vermonters are probably not as familiar with, because you were not in the state, not in the country. But it's about your family's experience in the Holocaust, and you going to visit your father and grandfather's town that they were essentially driven out of. And, of course, you fled Europe, your family did, when you were very young. What made you decide to kind of go find your roots?
Well, my father, as I say, didn't flee because of the Holocaust, but we found the cemetery in the next town where the Jewish cemetery was, and found my grandfather's grave and some other relatives. And it was a very moving experience. I went with my daughter. And the good news there was that the grave, or the keeper of the cemetery, which was kind of an official position, he had inspired the town to restore the cemetery. It had been destroyed, on the occasion of Kristallnacht, which was when the Nazis really revealed themselves and tore apart cemeteries and shot people and burned synagogues. And he was such a ray of hope that he was an extraordinary person. It was what we would call the good German, and made me realize there were many good Germans along with the Nazis. So it was very meaningful from a family point of view, but also from a larger point of view, that evil does not triumph in every situation.
The past became present in your role as ambassadors. You tried to persuade the Swiss banks. There was a whole issue there about abandoned bank accounts that you tried, and I don't know to what degree you were successful. Explain what happened and what you were trying to do.
Well, before and during World War II, Jews from Germany and Austria were deposit money in the Swiss banks, which was against the law. It was punishable by death to take money out of Germany. So there were like go-betweens who would deposit the money. And after the war, when the real owners of these accounts, those who survived, tried to get them back, and those who didn't survive, their heirs, tried to get them back. And the Swiss basically acted as if this was normal business, whereas they wouldn't help Jews find their accounts. They would, for those who died in the Holocaust, they would ask for death certificates, which clearly they were not given in the Nazi regime. So it was a long, drawn-out process, and to my surprise, I found my mother's name on the list of abandoned accounts. Turned out not to be a lot of money. I think we ended up with $150, which I divided with my brother. But the whole process of searching for the accounts, for the banks to come out honestly, that took a long time. And I played a part, but many people also played a part, and a judge in New York City actually was the one who finally decided that the banks had to come forth with all the information that they had. So I never experienced anti-Semitism in Vermont, thank goodness, but during this process I did, and so it was a good lesson. And also made me very grateful to be in the United States.
So the issue that you were raising then with the Swiss really didn't, you were unsuccessful in persuading them to kind of loosen the reins on these accounts at that time.
No, but eventually they did.
They did eventually.
Yes, and we had a long, and the Swiss appointed a commission that did a long, detailed study of Switzerland's role during World War II. And the United States also did a study of the role in World War II. The only problem was that the Swiss are so diligent and thorough that by the time the study came out, the issue was off the front page. But while I was there, it was on the front page almost every day.
And what was their role in World War II? We think of them as the neutral country. Were they?
The answer is almost. They weren't, they weren't. I mean, their answer was that they had to do some business with Germany because they were surrounded by German-occupied countries, France, Italy, Austria, Liechtenstein, I think that's still a debatable question. I think, by and large, they were neutral, but they weren't as well informed as about the Holocaust, because they were, neutrality also means keeping a distance. So I don't think they were fully aware of the concentration camps and the killing that went on.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation, and we're spending the hour this week talking with former Governor Madeline Cunin. She has a new book out called Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, and she is currently touring around the region, and particularly Vermont. You can catch her at a number of bookstores. I know she's going to be at Bridgeside Books in Waterbury on November 1st. Do you know of other dates off the top of your head?
Well, I'm going to be at the North Shore Bookstore. I'm going to be in Norwich. I don't know the dates off the top of my head.
Okay.
I'm going to be in Boston at Trident Books. I'm going to be in Washington. So I'm delighted that the book seems to resonate with people. I mean, that's what every author hopes for. I've had very generous audiences in that respect. I really respond.
Well, on the topic of the Holocaust, this summer I visited the Holocaust Museum in D.C. It was my first time there. And I could not help but be struck as I went from panel to panel about the parallels to today. It is almost as if Trump has ripped pages out of this history. There was a panel on the America First movement, and of course that is a slogan. That was a pro-Nazi movement, essentially, to not enter the war. A whole panel on enemies of the people. That was a phrase used during the Nazi era. Family separation was a hallmark of that time, which, you know, of course, was terrifying, and a whole speech that was spinning on an endless loop of Hitler addressing a crowd saying, you know, how I am the party. There is no party separate from me. And of course, we're seeing that kind of thing happening now, where Trump has become the party. You're either for him or against him. You know, are a product to some extent of that era. Do you see parallels?
Yes, not complete, thank goodness. I don't think there's obviously no concentration camps, no identifying of Jews or minorities or gay and lesbians and LGBT.
Well, that's where it started. I don't know about that. I mean, targeting of Muslims, I mean, there is a lot of that.
I was going to get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, there is discrimination, and it's disturbing. I think Trump gives us the impression that he'd like to go further, that he'd like to exclude a lot of immigrants. Even now, he's cutting by two-thirds the number of legal immigrants that can come to this country. So the tendency to identify people as the other, than white America, that is frightening. But I believe we have enough checks and balances in the United States, even at this difficult time, to prevent a Hitler-like experience. And I think the public is aware of what is happening by and large, at least in the Northeast, and I'm sure parts of the rest of the country. So, you know, the Women's March, the other marches that have taken place since then, demonstrates that democracy is still surviving here. But we have to be alert. I think we can't be sort of half asleep while these infringements on our democratic union are taking place. So, and of course, the most important check and balance is the vote, is the ballot box. So while I'm not advocating any results on the radio, it's clear that the vote will be terribly important in this midterm election. So I'll just wave the flag for that. But yes, the tendencies or the hints of fascism shouldn't go unreported or unreputed. We really have to fight to keep our democratic system and keep diversity and adhere to the words on the Statue of Liberty, which are so famous, "Give me your poor, you're hungry." And we were always the welcoming arm holding the torch. And of course, me and my family wouldn't have been able to come to America. We were very lucky that we were able to make that transition, even though our lives were not in immediate danger in Switzerland. There was a fear that Hitler would take over Switzerland as well.
You know, we grow up learning that our democracy is based on a three-legged stool of checks and balances, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judiciary, all of which can serve as a check and balance. Mm-hmm. But now we see the legislative branch has essentially abdicated any sort of meaningful, check system on the executive. And the judiciary, as of Brett Kavanaugh's appointment, we can't expect that they, too, would restrain them. Do you wonder if the system of checks and balances that we take some comfort in has been short-circuited?
No, I don't think it's been short-circuited, but it depends on the public in the next couple of months and couple of years. If people become activists in a positive way and you can work within the present system and defend it. That's my hope and my belief. But we all have to become activists to a certain degree. Not everybody wants to march in the streets, though I commend the young people and the older folks like me who turn out. But everyone can vote. Everyone can write to their congressman. And, you know, there's a whole new wave of people running for office. You know, 5 years ago, I founded something called Emerge Vermont, which is part of a national organization of about 20 states. And we recruit and train women to run for office. And so there's a record number of women running for office, hundreds. And that's a very healthy sign. And you take the young people from the school where teenagers were shot in Florida, and some of those teenagers are going around the country proselytizing for sensible gun control and to run for office. So I think there's been a reaction which has created a healthy activism around gun control, around just voting, and that's what's going to allow us to fight back and hold on to the blessings we have in democracy.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that.
I'm an optimist. You've got to be. You've got to find some hope, otherwise it's too darn depressing.
So the last year, we saw the rise of the Me Too movement. How surprised are you? You are a veteran of the women's movement, but this really is a milestone moment, an accountability moment. So how surprised have you been at this latest movement, the Me Too movement?
Well, I'm surprised and delighted. And delighted that it's not just a one-day event, it's continuing. And, you know, for years, ever since I was first elected to the Vermont legislature in 1972, I've been encouraging women to run. I've been encouraging legislation to protect women against sexual abuse. And now it's happening on the scale that we've never seen before. So it's the only worry I have is that there'll be backlash, and which is already beginning, that people feel they have to defend the men and the boys. And, of course, we do have to be careful that we go through a process when someone is accused that seems legitimate. But, you know, in a lot of these cases, like in the Dr. Ford case, where people say, well, there's no evidence. Well, when a woman is raped, it's usually not with onlookers, or when a woman is abused. So you have to, at some point, trust the person who is making the case for herself. But I think there's much more sensitivity, much more awareness. I mean, I was asked to testify on the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings in 1991. And then it was an all-male judiciary committee. And I remember it just stirred up this visceral anger in me that we had to speak against Clarence Thomas and in favor of Anita Hill. And they weren't even listening. The way they mocked Anita Hill, you remember, they said terrible things about her. So it just created a kind of fury. And that anger is being turned into activism. People say, well, I don't want to be my life to be determined by a panel of old white men. I want to be judged by my peers. And that's really what democracy is about. And I think this is a very, very healthy turnabout.
What was your role in the Anita Hill hearing? Why were you called to testify?
I was a former governor, and which I still am, but this was one of the few women in leadership, and Planned Parenthood asked me to join them.
What did you speak about? And, of course, you were very much, very recently a governor. Your term ended in January 91. Right. So what did you speak about?
I just spoke about the importance of having, we spoke about the importance of Roe v. Wade and holding on to that. And just that, I don't remember the exact words, yeah. Of course, it was a while ago, that I spoke for women.
What was the response from that all-male judiciary committee?
Nothing.
They just sat passively and listened?
Yeah. It was a little while later that one of the senators called Anita Hill a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty, and that's how she was regarded. And we felt a little diminished. Hmm. Yeah. So it wasn't quite a rerun of the Kavanaugh hearings, but there was that central question, do you believe someone who talks about being abused or witnessing abuse, the question of credibility. And there was also the same feeling of the boys will be boys. You know, the guys kind of huddle together and women are not heard. But I think we are making progress in that area, despite the Kavanaugh hearings. The fact that she had and continues to have so much support, and that the women on the Democratic side did believe her and asked her proper questions.
How do you assess at the end of the Kavanaugh hearings? You know, it strikes me in the last year we've had the Me Too movement on the one hand and the Kavanaugh hearings on the other. Do they sort of cancel each other out, or do you sense progress?
I do sense progress. And there's a sort of mutual support system. I think a woman who speaks up about sexual assault or violence has a community. And that was not true 27 years ago, not to the same degree anyway. I mean, there are a lot of people then who believed in Anita Hill, but it wasn't so persuasive or pervasive. So I think we've made progress. Not that we've solved, if it ever will be solved, but I think you're not as alone. And I think men are changing too. We have to give credit, as people don't, fathers don't want their daughters to be abused. And more women being in public life they'll speak up, and that's how you get change. You know, women have to be seated at the table where these decisions about sexuality and violence and abuse are being made. They have to be there so their voices can be equal to the men's.
You speak of the backlash, and conservative pundits are already talking about the quote-unquote war on men. And as I tell people, I guess I missed the memo that there was a war on me. I thought men were doing just fine, and a hymn to backlash. How do you respond to that notion that, you know, there is a war on men?
Well, I wouldn't agree with the war on men. I think that men are also being sensitized and educated about these complex and sometimes confusing incidents and experiences that many women have. So, you know, it's sort of the temper of the times. You're either for or against, you're either at war or at peace. And that's not a real reflection of how the world works. I do think men are being more aware. They may be more careful in their relationships and connections with women. But I think on the whole, this is a healthy movement. And we all want the best for our daughters, for our wives, for our mothers. So I think the negative part will not overpower the positive part. There's bound to be some negative, but I think the positive lessons we learn from this will prevail.
The whole Kavanaugh nomination, of course, is being viewed as a litmus test for the future of Roe v. Wade and whether abortion will continue to be safe and legal in the country. What is your take on that? That has been an issue that has been very much at the center of your political life for your entire political life. You've seen it from when abortion was illegal in Vermont.
Well, I haven't seen it when abortion was illegal in Vermont, but because Vermont law and constitution. Well, anyway, I wasn't in political office, and Vermont has been pretty progressive on that score for a long time. But yes, I think it's going to be difficult because of the new justice, associate justice, having been appointed. But the people who are really going to suffer are lower middle class and poor women, because upper middle class and wealthy women can shop around for an abortion. They can even travel to Australia if they want to, or England. And they can find, if in Vermont it'll stay legal, because we don't have that constituency, at least it's not vocal, it's not active, that would repeal Roe v. Wade. But I think it really punishes those people who can't find a safe and legal abortion, and I think we will have unsafe abortions throughout the country. One thing I can't understand is why birth control should also be withdrawn. I know that the fervid anti-abortion people think any form of birth control is also an abortion, but I guess I wish the same constituency would advocate for safe births. We have a very high rate of maternal deaths, of infant mortality. That's where we should put our energy and our money. But I think it's going to be hard in the next couple of years for all women to have equal rights to determine their own future and to do it safely.
You mentioned that there are a record number of women running for office. Many of them will, in all likelihood, win. Some will lose. What is your advice to those women about running and holding political office?
Well, I think campaign very hard. Try to reach every voter. Go door to door or door knocking and stand for something. Really express your priorities, not only in knocking down your opponent, but in really explaining to the public who you are and what you want. And I think, you know, in the old days, women and men used to climb the ladder. You'd start as a town legislator, town office holder, and then you'd slowly climb the stairs and maybe run for Congress or governor. But now people are coming in sideways. I mean, some of these resumes are so different. They may have worked in business, which was often true for men, but women didn't. And even the Democratic candidate for governor in Vermont had experience at the Vermont Energy Co-op. So, and candidates in New York had no prior business experience, but they represented a new constituency. Not so much in Vermont, but in New York. Where a long-time popular Democratic incumbent was defeated by a newcomer who was Hispanic and young and energetic. And so, and that only happened because people voted. I mean,
that's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
I was trying to think of her name, yes. Yeah. And that was a huge upset. So we need more. It won't work everywhere. But the key is still getting out the vote. We have a large Hispanic population in this country and with a very low voter record. So the key to keeping, I keep referring to democracy in the broad sense, we need to get people out to vote. So back to your question, what my advice is, work on voter turnout, be personable, be forthright, and be authentic. I think the reason people don't trust politicians because they think they're faking it. They're not really telling you who they really are. So try to be authentic, get around, and have a short but succinct and meaningful platform that people will resonate with.
Well, let's finish with having you read a poem from your new book, Coming of Age. And this is a love poem that you end the book with.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we can get back to love after talking too much about hate, probably. So this is the antidote. It's called a love poem. And it's dedicated to my husband. Each night, I wheel you to your door with a kiss on your lips. I smile, my love, at you, generously, I think. You don't know how much I love you, you say. I do, I do. We've formed a ritual of waving goodbye as I retreat slowly down the hall. At first, I wave with one hand in the air, and then my arms go wild before I turn the corner as if struck by a storm or signaling for help. We wave in tandem. You are there, and I am here. The nurses now know we wave not for them, but for one another, to have and to hold the love we swore to once and forever.
Well, Governor Madeline Cunin, thanks for joining us this week on the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thank you very much, David. I think we covered the waterfront, but I'm glad we can end up on hope.
Madeline Cunin is a former governor of Vermont and the author of a new book, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this in all shows at vermontconversation.com. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman, this special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, is underwritten in part by Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as Salvation Farms, which nourishes Vermont by distributing produce farmers can't sell. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, community, and economy. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, a proud B Corp using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. And by Stowe Cider, with crisp, clean, and creative award-winning flavors. Visit the tasting room in Stowe or buy Stowe Cider throughout New England, upstate New York, and Washington, D.C., as well as nearly 700 business members of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, who believe that sustainable business practices value people,